I actually can't tell you that.
Really? Just in case we like try to kidnap you to.
No, I can't tell you. Sorry.
Oh my gosh. Probably your office with a bottle of whiskey.
All right, let's go ahead and get started. As usual, keep the introduction super short. I'll let Ben basically introduce himself. I'll just kick it off by saying yesterday there was a bit of a social media kerfuffle about forecasting in which someone from HuffPost called Nate Silver said that he was kind of just guessing about the election, and Nate Silver responded by saying that that guy had no fucking idea what he was talking about. So let's see which of those Ben is going to offer. Are you just guessing, or...
Do I have no fucking idea what I'm talking about? Okay, yeah, right, good. Yep. So this is the question. So what am I going to do today? So I've got you as a captive audience here to hear exciting things about the results, and so I'm going to start by talking about methodology for 15-20 minutes, to tell you what we've been doing in terms of analyzing the pre-election polling, and then once I've done that, I'm going to tell you some stuff about what's going on at the sort of the micro level, and I'm going to make a case that in fact. Like, if you ignore the campaign, which has been not boring, at the micro level, like, you could look at these data, and, like, if you didn't know what was going on, like, this would be the least surprising set of data. Like, there's not that much interesting going on at the micro level versus other recent elections. There are some interesting patterns, changes in patterns of voting by gender, education, race, some slight realignments of the electoral geography, but it's like really very much within the scope of what we see from election to election typically in recent American history. And then at the end, I'm going to talk about the sort of the important part of the estimates in some sense for the forecasting element. Clinton is ahead. Exactly how far ahead, I'll talk a little bit about. It's on the order of Obama's lead in 2012, as best as we can tell. And polls can be off by that much. And we think, although not everyone agrees, that Trump has a bit of an electoral college advantage just due to the constellation of states, which I'll show you a bit about. And so whereas Obama's 3.9% lead meant that he was up by 5.5% in sort of the pivotal state that would have flipped the Electoral College, probably the direction of that 1.5-point gap has reversed. So it is perhaps a bit closer than that appears. Okay, so this is all based on a collaboration with Doug Rivers, mostly in his YouGov hat rather than his Stanford hat. Delia Bailey at YouGov and Jack Blumenau, who is there, have also worked extensively on the project. The estimates I'm going to be talking about, some of the detail of them is posted at this URL. We haven't posted today's update yet because it's still running. I'll tell you more about the computation later. But it'll be up later this afternoon, and there'll be one more post sometime on Tuesday with the polling data from today. Right, so math. So this is sort of how we think about, how we're thinking about the problem of estimating what's going to happen. There are three components that we're thinking about. So we're thinking about sort of voter types. A voter type is a set of measurable characteristics, age, gender, education, who you voted for in 2012, if you were eligible, things like that, where you live. And what we would like to do is estimate for each of these voter types three quantities. We need to know what proportion of them will vote for each candidate among those who do vote. We need to know what proportion of that voter type will turn out to vote. And we need to know what proportion of the electorate is of each type. And in principle, you know, you could work here from registered voters, or you could work from the entire electorate. And, you know, these two stages have to, you know, use a consistent definition there. But either way, you basically, you know, how many people are there? How many of them will vote? Of those who vote, how will they vote? And, you know, if you sort of accumulate those and you have reasonable estimates of all of those things, you should get the right answer for how the election is going to turn out. And moreover, you, by virtue of decomposing it this way, you can look at various slices of the electorate fairly easily. So this is the sort of framework that we're working within. As far as I can tell, there isn't really a terribly compelling alternative to this logical framework. It's just that a lot of polling doesn't make this very explicit. So I'm going to talk basically about, just quickly, how we do this, and how we do this, each on one slide, one very dense slide. So first step, estimating vote conditional on turning out and other explanatory variables. The key assumption that we're making here is that we can do this with a large online opt-in panel, even though it is all of those things. Large is good. Online and opt-in are less good. And what we need is to be able to correctly estimate or get pretty close to correctly estimating for someone who is age 18 to 22, male, high school educated, living in Nebraska in the 2nd Congressional District. We want to be able to estimate reasonably precisely what proportion of those people will vote for Trump, what proportion of those people will vote for Clinton, etc. And so what we have, we've got the YouGov's US panel, which is very large. We've got about 5,000 to 10,000 responses per day. We're going to have a lot today. We have saved up some people. So per day nationally, so that, you know, divide by 50 for the average number per state, we're using a 14-day data window. At the moment, we're up to like 70,000 observations in our window. But we're modeling internal time trends. So, you know, even though we've got 14 days of data, we're not taking the average across those 14 days. We're using all those 14 days to figure out the relevant demographic patterns, and then also to figure out what's going on in terms of the time trend internally to that. So our estimates are where we think things were on the last day of polling that we're reporting, which in this case is, unfortunately, not yesterday because the estimates are not done, but 2 days ago. So the key variables, congressional district, state, race, age, education, marital status, gender, and the really critical one, which is 2012 vote, which is, well, I'll discuss how predictive it is in a second. Well, minutes, not seconds. It's a multi-level model, multinomial logistic regression with lots and lots and lots of interactions. Many things are interacted at the state level, so demographic relationships can be different across states. Many other things are interacted in other ways. Because of the way we're doing the estimation, we can really go overboard with the interactions, and we have. It's sort of been very stable across specifications. Like, you add things in, remove them, nothing happens. It's a pretty well-saturated model with good regularization. So there are potential problems here if these panelists have different preferences than the public, conditional on everything in the model. We will get the wrong answer. If their 2012 vote measures are biased, we will have big problems because it's an incredibly powerful predictor. We've validated that pretty extensively. We think that's okay for a variety of reasons. Key among them is that it's a panel, and so those are not contemporaneous measures of 2012 vote, contemporaneous to the report of vote intention for 2016. For many panelists, they are contemporaneous to the 2012 election. For some people, they're more recent than that, but they're not. It's not that we ask them how they're voting in this election and how they voted in 2012. It's that we already know how they said they voted in 2012 long, long ago. So that's that's how we estimate vote preferences conditional on turning out.
And what do you do for the people who didn't vote in 2012?
It's a category. There are multiple categories. There's you were eligible to vote and didn't vote in 2012. There's you were under 18 in 2012 and are no longer under 18. So those are sort of, and obviously there's also voted for a third party in there as well. So there are actually five categories of 2012 vote. We could have seven.
Okay, so you're just taking them as different categories.
They're basically different categories. But because things are heavily interacted, it ends up being reasonably okay in terms of our ability to estimate that, yes, indeed, you know, 18 to 21-year-olds, even though we don't know their lagged vote, they turn out to lean very heavily towards Clinton, that does come out of the data, nonetheless. So, so the 2012 vote is useful for the vast majority of people who have a 2012 vote in predicting their vote, but for young people, they're a separate category.
Right, and also, I mean, that proportion of people that didn't turn out in 2012 is presumably not orthogonal to the
Right? So I'm not going to show you that much about that group. They lean Trump, not super, super heavily, because it's a mix of people who are disaffected, people who, Hispanic turnout has traditionally been pretty low, so that may be up. So some, so it's a mix of people. It does that group does lean Trump. They're not going to be a huge fraction of the electorate, but they will be in some of the electorate. It's more probably people voting this time who didn't vote in 2012 is more people than the young voters, but not that much more than the newly eligible voters in terms of the aggregates. So estimating turnout. This is one of the most difficult parts of doing election polling is it's pretty easy. Well, it's relatively easy to figure out who people are going to vote for. And there are a variety of issues that come up in terms of figuring out what turnout is going to be. So the big problems are, first, the one people tend to focus on, which is just that people will lie. So if you ask people, are they going to vote, they may be lying, they may be over-optimistic, but you're likely to end up with very high rates of claimed prospective turnout. The other problem, though, is the people you're able to find to poll are likely to be they may well be far more unrepresentative in terms of their engagement with politics than they are in terms of their left-rightness, so their Democrat versus Republican leanings. And so another reason that polls are likely to overstate turnout is because they are, it's an election poll. Like, people know there's an election coming. If they don't want to answer an election poll, they're not going to answer an election poll. There are big problems with sort of forming a direct estimate from contemporaneous polling. And so we have made the decision that we're not going to try. What we use is the 2012 current population survey, which is a post, so it's the November wave of the CPS, done after the 2012 election. It's a high-quality probability sample, U.S. government survey, very high response rate compared to anything that, we normally do in terms of election polling. And they ask people whether they turned out. It's a self-report. It's generally a little high based up versus the administrative data, although people argue about exactly how high it is based on some difficulties with interpreting exactly the eligible population, et cetera. We've decided to go with that. So basically what we've done is we've decided that we would rather have a high-quality estimate of 2012 turnout patterns than a low-quality estimate of 2016 turnout patterns. This opens up a number of possible biases that I'll talk about later, having to do with turnout shifts. The thing about turnout shifts, though, is they're not as bad. Being wrong on turnout is never as bad. The worst it can be is as bad as being wrong on vote choice. Usually it's much less bad than being wrong on vote choice because whatever turnout differential you have is multiplied by the difference in voting patterns between the two groups, which is, less than one. Sometimes it's not very big. So this is a potentially, potentially dangerous way to go, but we think it's actually safer than the alternative. So this is what we've done. Again, multi-level, state-level, logistic regression, lots of interactions. Again, could be wrong. If turnout patterns are very different than in 2012, we could have problems. If indeed, Republicans are radically demobilized by Trump, then we will overstate Trump's support. If, on the other hand, there are lots of disaffected voters who are really excited by Trump as a way to, stick a finger in the eye of the political system, then we will go get it wrong the other way. In some sense, nobody knows this, and I don't think anyone has a very good way to get a handle on this with real data, so we are going to use the fact that traditionally in the U.S., voting is reasonably stable. Whether you turned out last time is a good predictor of whether you'll turn out this time. Yeah.
And So YouGov does this, but does everyone make the same choice, or is this where...
No. No one else makes the same choice. No one. This is not how most people do it.
Okay.
This worked really well for Brexit, which I'll get back to in a second. So the third piece is just what proportion of the electorate is of each type. This is just a huge exercise in like trying to figure out what the population looks like. We start with the 1% sample of the 2010 census. We sort of fix the margins using more recent census data. We impute registration onto this using voter files. We impute 2012 vote onto this using the 2012 polling data and all the covariates that are in here, subject to the constraint of the actual election results, so we've got the right number of people who voted for the right parties in 2012. I left off this. We apply the mortality tables, so we kill off the old people at the right rates and all of that, so that actually the 2012 vote looks even better for Obama than the actual 2012 vote, because old people disproportionately voted for Romney and they disproportionately died. We don't have mortality by voting, but we don't anticipate that that's a huge problem. So there are, again, ways that this could be wrong. We could be wrong in terms of the 2012 vote imputation. That would have potentially some serious consequences, but this gives us a really detailed frame. What this gives us is actually basically 2 million pseudo-observations that form our U.S. population with weights, which are roughly 100 people each, and so we can construct fitted values onto this and add it all up and get our estimates. So we do this whole thing with it's basically a multi-level regression and post-stratification approach with sort of two multi-level models, and we estimate the whole thing sort of all at once, aside from the imputations that I mentioned, which we do first. It's implemented in STAN. We fit this as 37 parallel MCMC chains on Amazon Web Services on a 40-core cluster. It was taking about 8 hours estimation time. As we've ramped up the sample size, it's now taking closer to 12, which is why I don't have yesterday's estimates. We're pulling the data sort of in the evening each day. This is not true. But a little later than that Eastern time today, so... So that's the methodology. It's a fairly high tech, isn't it? There's a lot to it. Like there's a lot of modeling here, and we had to put together some data sets and make some choices about how to do the imputations and things like that. We think it's likely to work pretty well. The reason we think it's likely to work pretty well is that we did it before in the UK. Of course, different country, different data sets. We used this setup for the EU referendum. We never estimated Remain ahead during the entire time we were doing it. It got really close at one point. It was like 50.1. But actually, up until... it was mostly in the 51 to 52 range and then sort of narrowed at the end. Our final estimate was leave 50.6 versus 51.9 as the actual result. YouGov didn't really publicize this very well, but we did post it online before the election, so you're not just trusting me that we did this. Mostly they publicized their other polls, which showed Remain ahead, which, their choice. It worked really well, not just at the level of the entire country, but if you look at the local authority reporting areas for which we know the counts, we were really close. They were correlated. The estimates at the local authority level were correlated with the results at 0.92. The root mean square error in terms of the share support for Remain was about 4%. So if you want to read a little on that, it's posted on my blog, with my other three blog posts. And the other thing we've done to test this is we retroactively applied the methodology to the 2012 U.S. election. We didn't cheat. We didn't train the model on the 2012 U.S. election. We set up the whole model. We were running it on 2016, and then we put together the data for 2012. We ran it once, and we got almost exactly the right result. We missed one state, which was one of the closest states. So... one of the things we did then do, though, was look at the degree of undercoverage in the interval estimates, and basically feed that back into as extra error, extra uncertainty into our 2016 estimates. So hopefully we'll have better coverage in terms of the uncertainty, at least in terms of sort of state level variation around the estimates. So now some of what we're seeing in the data. So this is one of my favorite tables to look at just in terms of understanding this election, because it shows you just sort of how stable things are. This is 2012 vote in the rows, 2016 vote intention in the columns. Among the people who are going to vote, we do have estimates. We're not assuming everyone who voted in 2012 will vote this time. We're using the sort of, again, from 2012, we're basically using information from the 2008 to 2012 comparison from voter files to figure out sort of how many people vote in one election and then not in the next. There are some issues with the voter files, but we think it's a reasonable estimate. It's like single-digit estimate. Most people do vote if they voted in the previous election. But, yeah, 88% of people who voted for Obama who are going to vote this time are going to vote for Clinton, 87 for Trump. There is some attrition to the third-party candidates. It's sort of as you would expect. Romney vote all goes to Johnson. Clinton vote goes to both Johnson and Stein. Obama vote goes to both Johnson and Stein. This differential has been really stable, that more Obama voters switch to Trump than Romney voters switch to Clinton. The Romney voters tend to go to third parties to a slightly greater degree. These estimates that I'm showing you are actually a little more favorable to Clinton than in recent days. These have usually been the same number. So there's been a little bit of net traffic from Obama, from Democrat to Republican, among people who voted in 2012. However, then there are all these other people. There are the people who voted for third parties in 2012, which is 2% of the people. That's not very important. More important are the 9% who didn't vote for anyone who we think will vote. This time, this is proportion of the voters we expect this time. So we expect 9% will be people who did not vote in 2012 but could have voted in 2012. And we have them leaning Trump a bit, but not enormously. It's a little difficult to pin down this group. This is a place we could be wrong, but yeah, this is not a huge number unless the turnout also goes up. If we're wrong on both this and the turnout rate of this group, then maybe there's a bigger problem. Under 18, 64 to 20. That's obviously helping Clinton a lot, because even though they're only 5%, this is sort of worth, like, this is worth a few points of margin. Basically, this compensates for this. What that means is basically that's why we basically end up back at the 2012 national result, give or take, because Clinton is losing about as much among the 2012 voters and non-voters as she gains because of the 18 to 21s. This is the most interesting thing, at least to me, that's happening sort of demographically, which is there's a really reasonably, given the low transition rates in general, there's a pretty strong education effect. So among Obama voters from 2012, as you go up in education, Clinton retains more of those people. Trump gains far fewer of those people. The people that Trump is gaining from the Obama vote are heavily low-education voters. And among Romney voters, the patterns run in the other direction in mirror image. So high school-educated Romney voters, almost very few are defecting to Clinton, very few are defecting to Johnson. As you go up to higher education, more defecting to Clinton, more defecting to Johnson. Interestingly, not much of an effect in terms of education for defections to third parties among Obama supporters. It's really all in the Trump versus Clinton comparison. But, you know, these are pretty big differences. So, you know, this is like three times the defection rate of this. This is, you know, twice the defection rate of this. Of course, there are a lot more people in these categories than in these categories. So that's the education pattern. I mean, this is not shocking probably to anyone because, you know, this has sort of been in the news as a thing that other people have picked up, but often people have just focused on the education effect as a fixed thing. This is showing that it's a pattern in the switching.
But is this surprising relative to previous elections? Right, if we were to go back to the 2008 Obama vote, would we see similar proportions?
Well, so 2008 versus 2004, I don't actually know if we would see exactly the same patterns. Probably we wouldn't see anything in 2008 versus 2012 because there was just so little transition at all. Mm-hmm. I don't know, 2004, Bush versus Kerry versus... I'm not sure. I'm not sure you would see this. This is definitely accentuating education differences between basically the association between education and voting, which has traditionally not been monotonic, partially because of confounding with race that most of the people who are in the lowest education category, they're disproportionately Black and Hispanic, and those groups vote at a very high rate.
That would be that, you know, a lot of more educated people are moving more and more towards the Republican Party over the last decade. And so is this just...
Wait, really? Towards the Republican Party?
No, towards the Democratic Party.
Okay, that's not what you said.
Sorry. I'm not American, but my priorities are a lot of more...
You are an American, though.
I'm an American. I can speak authoritatively.
Yeah, there you go.
Right, that as people become more educated, they're shifting towards the Democratic Party, and is this just picking up a trend line, or is this something...
So, I mean, these are the same people, right? So these are actual shifts for the same people at a moment in time. They're not changing in education. They're not changing...
Right, but you still could be picking up that trend within the same people. If education is a greater predictor of...
So that's right. This is what this is telling you, is that education... I mean, this is another way of saying education is becoming an increasingly... is increasingly associated with vote choice in this election versus previous elections. But yes, it's not. This is not like reversing some old pattern in some profound way. Yeah. Transitions by race, sort of what you would expect. White voters who voted for Obama, again, this is nationally, 8% moving to Trump, 86% staying with Clinton, higher retention rates among Blacks, not surprisingly, among Hispanics, maybe a little surprising that that's lower, although I'll get back to the question of whether we're estimating Hispanics well later. White vote retention for Romney to Trump is higher, losing more Black and Hispanic voters. You might wonder, you know, why is this not starker? I think the basic answer is, like, there weren't that many Black Romney voters or Hispanic Romney voters, and, you know, If you were African American or Hispanic and you voted for Romney, you were probably a very committed Republican, and so you're probably still a very committed Republican. So, you know, that's probably part of the explanation for why you don't see more movement here. It is, you know, substantially more movement than anywhere else here, but it's, you know, and it's also just not that many people.
And how are you collapsing racial categories? So is that...
It's non-Hispanic white, non-Hispanic Black, non-Hispanic other, and Hispanic. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is the biggest category the other race, ethnicity, is that Asians?
Yeah, I think it would end up being Asian.
I'm surprised how few Romney voting Asians are switching to play.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a question here again about like coverage of the panel, but yep. I agree that it's a little bit surprising that it's not starker there. Gender, I had to change the text on this slide because this changed a little bit over the last few days, but there's a little bit of a transition effect here, but it's not very big. It's not very big in either case. So Clinton is holding the Obama female vote better than the Obama male vote. Trump is holding the Romney male vote better than the Romney female vote, but you know those are not anything like the education differences. They're not nothing, but we're not seeing like a dramatic sorting of male and female voters into, you know, with respect to the parties. We're seeing a little bit of accentuation of the existing gender gap, which has always pointed in this direction. Well, not always, but for most of recent American history. We can look at these sort of transitions also at the state level. So this is just showing sort of what's happening in the states that are worst for Democratic retention. The worst state for Democratic retention is West Virginia, which has been trending Republican for a while and is going to be really Republican this time. There's a whole there are a whole set of issues around coal and some things that Clinton said regarding the coal industry. So Clinton's going to do very badly in West Virginia, a state that voted Democrat not so, or was a reliable Democratic state not so long ago. Voted for Bill Clinton twice by good margins. South Dakota, Montana, Hawaii is to some extent just a, you know, that was a home state advantage for Obama, which is sort of being given back. But you know, the sort of the interesting ones here are these two. So these are, you know, this is 15. So these are among the less good states for Democratic retention: Ohio and Pennsylvania, Nevada as well. So those are all important ones. Most of these other ones are uncompetitive in one direction or the other. Best states for Democratic retention, kind of amazingly, best is at the bottom now. So best is D.C. They don't want Trump anywhere near them. Interestingly, second, Mississippi, but Mississippi has the largest racial voting gap in the country. So like 99% of blacks voting Democrat, not quite that, 95. And like 18% of whites voting Democrat, or 10%, it's really low. So, you know, this is basically telling you none of the black Mississippians are defecting to Trump, which should shock no one. But interestingly, then you have Georgia, which is going to be part of the reason why we think Georgia is more competitive than other people think. Clinton's retaining Obama's vote in Georgia really well. You actually see a lot of southern states here. Which are possibly, you know, North Carolina, potentially trending a bit towards the Democrats as a result. You also see some totally safe Democratic states here. It's an interesting mix. Utah, that's sort of, again, Romney, sort of, in some sense, you know, if you voted for the Democrat last time when you had, someone with a not exactly home state, but sort of home state advantage, you're probably going to do it again this time. Plus, there are other things going on in Utah, Texas, South Carolina, New Hampshire. Anyway, so those are the best states for Democratic retention. Here are the worst states for Republican retention. Again, people in D.C. don't want Trump anywhere near them. Utah, again, this has been in the news because of this. We don't think we have a great handle on the McMullen vote. It's probably going to be higher than we estimate. We have it sort of in the teens at the moment, partly just because our survey question is not really designed to get at candidates beyond Clinton, Trump, Johnson, and Stein. So we may be understating that. But again, it's an interesting mix of states that are sort of, you know, many of these are sort of Democratic-leaning states, but they're not all. And then best states for Republican retention, doing very well in sort of the upper west, plain states type things. But, again, Alabama, Mississippi, high retention rates because, you know, high racial voting. West Virginia, again, this ongoing trend. Upper South, again, Kentucky, Tennessee. These are, again, states that have been trending Republican for a while and seem to be continuing to do so. What this turns into in terms of state-level change, and sorry, this is a little small. I mean, so in some sense, this is the, like, not that much is changing plot. Like, so this is 2012 two-party vote share for Obama, and this is estimated Clinton two-party vote share. It's like it's mostly on the diagonal. There's D.C. Hawaii and Vermont are falling back a bit from the very high vote shares that Obama got there for probably different reasons. But mostly things are sort of on the diagonal. There's some that stick out, like Georgia here. We'll come back to whether we're totally off the wall in Georgia. But it's mostly diagonal. If you plot the swings against two-party vote share, you can see there's like a little bit of a like attenuation of differences, which could be modeling problems or it could be real. I wouldn't exactly call it depolarization. This line corresponds to winning the seat this time, just because of the different scales of X and Y. It's not 45 degrees, but you can again see Georgia as a state which we have swinging pretty heavily towards Clinton, which, you know, and in this case, in this particular version of the estimate, it's just enough for her to win, basically tied. But you can also see North Carolina, Florida, Ohio, Nevada, sort of all along this line, all very close. And those are all these states that are like clustered right there. There should basically, it looks to us like there are going to be a lot of very close states, more perhaps than usual. These are the estimated state level margins, which does not show up because this projector doesn't do red. So this is a little bit of political commentary from the LSE IT department. That's dark. Wow. Yeah, I mean, it's mostly just a pretty map. It's prettier up here than it is up there. That just, yeah. Probability of victory. So these are, instead of vote shares, probability of victory. The coloring scheme is the same. The coloring scheme in both cases, the probability of victory. So probability for Clinton, 61, 66, 55, 82, 74, 59, 80. Those are essentially, these are nearly 100. But yeah, basically, you know, the interesting states are Florida, no one else agrees with us, Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Iowa, Nevada, maybe Colorado, Wisconsin, Maine, well, one congressional district in Maine, anyway. We have a vanishingly small but non-zero probability of Clinton winning Mississippi. This probably is a modeling problem, just again having to do with the extreme racial voting effect there. But there is a logic to it, which is that there's no room for Trump to gain people in his core demographics of low education, white voters in Mississippi, because they're all Republicans already, which isn't true in most parts of the country. So if he loses high education Mississippians, there's not going to be a compensating move in the other direction. So I do think our estimates that suggest that Mississippi will be a bit closer than in previous elections are plausible. I don't expect it to flip. Does that work any better? That does work a little better, thankfully. This beautiful plot was put together by Jack. The heights are proportional to the electoral vote. The bands are our uncertainty estimate, again, inflated. The actual sampling uncertainty here is very low. Most of this is driven by our added uncertainty for non-sampling. So non-sampling uncertainty that we have based on the extent to which our 2012 estimates are off, which is why they're sort of all around the same size. But what you can see, and sort of what we think is kind of the interesting story here in terms of the Electoral College, is the national popular vote estimate is this dotted line. The pivotal states are closer than that. Now, there's a question of which of these states are really going to be the pivotal states. You know, there are a whole bunch of states here very close together. The states, so these are Colorado and Wisconsin around the national vote difference. But then Clinton needs to win more than that. She needs to win at least one of, and perhaps two of, depending on which ones, of North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Iowa, Nevada, Florida, and Ohio. Those are the likely places to get the remaining electoral votes. And in these estimates, at least, and I'll get to where our national number is for these estimates, like, you know, she gets there. She actually wins almost all of these. But they're all really close. These are really small. These are small margins, and it's certainly within the realm of possibility that they all end up over there. But there are a number of different combinations, and so, you know, to the extent that the errors are uncorrelated, she's in pretty good shape. To the extent the errors are correlated, she's in less good shape. As I said before, no one else seems to think that Georgia is this close, and everyone else seems to think that Arizona is closer. I think I buy the story for Arizona being closer. I don't really see why we would be wrong on Georgia, but certainly possible. And also, everyone else thinks that Pennsylvania is much safer than this, which, again, I don't really buy the demographics on that, for reasons I'll tell you about in a second. The Electoral College advantage for Trump. This is mostly what I just said. This has been pretty stable. It's been about 1.5 to 2%, which is to say that the pivotal state has been about 1.5 to 2%, sort of further towards Trump than the national vote. And it's basically about wasted votes in California and New York, because if you look at this, there are no Republican states that are this big that are this lopsided. There isn't anything down here. Texas is the big Republican state, and it's not that lopsided anymore. In the past, part of the reason why there wasn't an electoral college advantage in this direction, at least in a stable way, obviously there was in 2000, is just that Texas was further over that way, Arizona was further over that way, some of the sort of medium-sized states here were further over. And so that's not true anymore, and that just means that, you know, to make this all balance, this line and these lines are not going to be in the same place necessarily. Notice, though, this changes pretty radically if we're wrong about PA, right? If we're wrong about Pennsylvania, and actually it's like over here, then actually, you know, this shifts down and it doesn't look like quite as serious a disadvantage. Pennsylvania, right. So Pennsylvania is really important. 20 electoral votes, it's pretty big. Obama won by 5.5 points in 2012, so a little more than his national margin. But it has been sort of slowly and fitfully drifting Republican relative to the national vote in recent elections. And it's hard to come up with a state that's really much more demographically, you know, strong for Trump. It has a substantial low education white population, but one that has traditionally voted at least to a decent degree for the Democratic Party because it's a northern state. So there's room for gains for Trump there. The minority population is primarily black rather than Hispanic, which means there's more likely to be a turnout letdown versus Obama in 2012 than, you know, a big turnout increase among Hispanic voters. Black voters voted at the same rate roughly as white voters nationally in 2012 and in 2008. Hispanic voters at a lower rate, so there's more room for Hispanics to go up. There isn't much room for the black vote to go up. So you should watch Pennsylvania. It's very difficult for Trump to win without Pennsylvania. If we go back to this plot, if you move Pennsylvania up here and you keep Colorado and Wisconsin up here, you know, that's it. That's a Clinton win. So Pennsylvania is important. People seem to think it's safer than I think it is. It is the most likely tipping point state in our analysis, although it's not the only one. There are a few others that are close. I actually hadn't told you what the national vote estimate was on which these estimates were based. Our estimates ticked up on Sunday, these estimates based on the Saturday data towards Clinton. They had been around 3% margin for Clinton the previous few days. They bumped up to 4.5%. This is going to come back down based on my quick glance at the raw data that is currently going through this enormously complicated model. So I don't take 4.5% here as our best current estimate. It's going to be something more on the order of 3.5, something like that. We'll see once the model runs. This is based on my eyeballing some diagnostics. That means that this probability, 96% for a Clinton win, is going to come back down. This was actually around 80% the previous few days. I think 80% is a reasonable guess. If Trump wins, he will almost surely win with a minority of the popular vote, just, you know, for added political fun. He will win by putting together the right few states, basically. The Electoral College map is conspiring to make that easier than it might be, but that's our sense of where things are. Yeah, so this is this uptick that I'm pretty sure will go away once we have another day's data. So these are Saturday respondents. The Sunday respondents seem to be more pro-Trump than the Saturday respondents, who seem to be more pro-Hillary. We don't have great day-of-the-week adjustment in here. We have huge sample sizes. I mean, this is like 7,500 people. So, you know, it's a real tick up, conditional on everything. But, yeah, I speculated to Jack earlier that this perhaps suggests an important fact about America, which is that Democrats watch pro football and Republicans watch college football. And so the people that you get on I just made up this fact. It's a way of explaining this. It's that don't believe. It could be true. It's not implausible. But okay, so why might we be wrong? Many reasons, beyond sort of programming errors and things like that. Sort of generic reasons, turnout patterns might be consequentially different than 2012. The sense in which we're using the turnout patterns from 2012 is we're assuming that the probability of voting conditional on having voted in the last election is similar. The probability of transitioning from a non-voter to a voter is similar conditional on age and gender and various things. Those are the kinds of patterns we're assuming. We're assuming a kind of overall turnout rate that's very similar to 2012. This could be wrong. We assumed this for Brexit, and it was wrong. Turnout was way up. It was way up in some places and not in others. So Scotland, it was down versus the general election. Everywhere else, it was up. It didn't end up messing up the estimates that much, again, because getting the turnout a little bit wrong is not a huge deal. For sort of not really thinking carefully about turnout rates, which is what a disturbing number of pollsters do, leads you to make far crazier assumptions than simply assuming that turnout patterns look like they've looked in the past. So we think it's the best available approach, but that doesn't mean it can't be wrong. And the YouGov panel might be conditionally unrepresentative of the electorate's voting behavior. Maybe there are higher risks of this time because of the weirdness of the Trump candidacy. We know the YouGov panelists are more politically attentive than typical people, not just because they get all these political surveys, but just because they're sort of engaged with the world enough to sign up to do these surveys for a very small amount of money. There's some specific reasons we might get things wrong in either direction. So reasons we might understate Clinton. If there's depressed turnout among Republicans, we don't have a great way of getting a handle on that. If there's increased turnout among Hispanics, again, we don't have a great way of getting a handle on that. We have poor online panel coverage of Hispanics who primarily speak Spanish, who lean more Democrat than those who do not primarily speak Spanish. So we may be understating Clinton's support among Hispanics. You would be when you see the breakdowns across different pollsters for the Hispanic vote, they are wildly all over the place. So Latino Decisions did a poll that was released yesterday that had a 74-18 split. I think it was a live interview poll. And then there are other polls where Hispanics are leading Clinton by 5 or 10 points. You look at this and what's going on? I think the 5-10 points thing is definitely wrong. 74-18 is a pretty serious split. We don't have quite that large a split. We have a substantial, it's not the black vote, but it's a pretty substantial difference. But we still might be understating that. That would help Clinton in some places, Florida, most consequentially, Florida and Nevada. It won't help her in Pennsylvania. Or some of the, Ohio, Iowa, some of the other swing states. So, it would be a differential effect in terms of where we were wrong. The other thing is we could have, we've done our best to sort of get the composition of the electorate right, but sort of most of the demographic trends helped Clinton, and we may not have gotten all of them exactly right. Reasons we might understate Trump: increased turnout among disaffected non-voters. There are plenty of people out there in the U.S. who didn't vote in 2012, didn't vote in 2008, Trump might appeal to them. This is sort of the sort of Brexit-y turnout story. Decreased turnout among black voters versus 2012. It seems plausible that while Trump is fairly threatening if you're an African American, Obama was someone who many African Americans were very excited to vote for. So turnout rates could decline among black voters. There have also been substantial efforts to disenfranchise black voters in certain states like North Carolina, where that could be consequential. Johnson supporters coming home. We've already seen a bit of this. Most of the Johnson supporters come from Romney voters. Third-party candidates tend to decline as elections approach. We've already seen that pattern. Maybe it's done. Maybe there's, some of it happens between the final poll and the ballot box. Third-party candidates always underperform their polls. So the question is sort of how much, where does it go? So there's a bit of room for Trump to gain a bit from there. And then there's, of course, the social desirability bias question. Who knows? Online polls certainly, you know, ought to mitigate this, but that doesn't mean it goes away. So that's it. That's all I've got. Happy to answer any questions. Yes?
Then I think this is really fascinating, and I hope you're right.
I hope our point estimates are right. I'm not...
Well, I think, though, that, you know, from an academic interest rather than the political one, something that I keep coming across in opinion polling at the moment is that, you know, we have this inherent problem with assembling, and who knows what the bias is or isn't. But I think what is really interesting is the kind of the results and some of the things you're hinting at regarding the many different variables you've included in the model and interaction effects, and also actually the domination of some of the variables over others. And I think that that is really worth exploring, especially, you know, you point out the education level, and for example with the Remain or the Brexit results, what came out there was that education trumps income,
yeah,
economic situation, which is a new phenomenon in Europe, really, mm-hmm. that before we've always been able to sort of look at income and have that as a predictor, but now that is no longer sufficient. It has to be down to certainly some sort of consideration of education as well. So I wonder if you have any thoughts on the model in terms of not the dependent variable, but rather like what actually happens in the model regarding all the various variables that you've here.
Yeah, so this kind of modeling is very much oriented towards the prediction problem, that is, getting good estimates for the conditional probability of voting for a particular candidate for someone with particular demographics, which means that, you know, this model is, like, it's got a ton of stuff in it, ton of interactions. I would be lying to you if I told you that I'd actually looked at the coefficients for any of these. I haven't, and I don't care what they are, because they're almost impossible to interpret because there's so many interactions. Like, just the mental gymnastics you'd have to do would go on. But they're sort of not the point. I mean, what we're really just trying to do is model this complicated response surface of, you know, conditional probabilities as a function in these different things. And then what we can do then is sort of look at the sort of the more basic marginal and combinations of things in terms of the predictions after the post-stratification. And so that was part of what I was showing you with those tables. There, I also have sort of plots that show things by education by race, the relationship between vote and education is different for blacks, whites, Hispanics. There's a big pattern for whites, there's a slight pattern for Hispanics, and there's nothing for blacks. It doesn't matter what your education level is. And, you know, there are lots of other things like that that come out of these interactions, and then it's just a matter of sort of going through and, like, slicing the things different way. I've done that.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I've done more.
The graphics of all of that is really, like, something we actually know quite little about.
Yeah. Well, so here we know a fair amount, because as I'm saying, like, not that much has changed. It was more interesting to do that with the Brexit version of this, because party didn't predict nearly as well, right? So there was no lagged vote, because no one had voted on the EU referendum recently, or on EU membership recently. So we had lots of plots sort of showing, you know, education, vote by education among 2015 Tories among 2015 Labour voters, et cetera, and, like, lots of, again, interestingly different patterns, you know, generally going in the same direction, but often with radically different slopes. You know, education almost unpredictable among Lib Dem voters, whereas, you know, hugely predictive among Tories, things like that. So, yeah, so, I mean, I think this stuff is, I mean, this kind of thing is interesting for, in some sense, you can decouple the model you fit from the from the questions you ask when you do these MRP models. So, you know, we fit the model with a ton of interactions, but then what we actually calculate and save and look at are, you know, these various slices across different subgroups. And, you know, sometimes two-way subgroups, sometimes, you know, just one-way subgroups. And the model, hopefully, is flexible enough that we're getting interesting, you know, and real patterns across those. But obviously, this all does all rely on having a huge data set. So, you know, the YouGov panel is big. We've got 70,000 observations here. The observations from 10 days ago may not be great for figuring out what the level is today, but the demographic patterns are very, very similar. So that's part of why it's useful to have all that data. It's not so much because we care that much what the internal trend is across 14 days, but it's because the demographic patterns 14 days ago are not going to be wildly different than the ones today. And so we get a lot of leverage on actually interpreting today's data from knowing what the demographic patterns are. So, yeah, that's probably a long-winded answer.
Yep. Yeah, so good question. So obviously missing from this model is basically the campaign. So mobilization, advertising, you know, weird patterns of endorsement between members of Congress and say, Trump. You know, two sides to that question. One, do any of those things matter? And two, since that's the subject of a huge body of political science research, what does the ease of predicting the election without that information say?
Well, so to the extent that that stuff changes vote preference, we should get it because it should show up in the polling data subject to various concerns. To the extent that it affects turnout patterns, we have done absolutely nothing to try to capture it. Intentionally, as I defended. I stick by that as a choice for prediction because I don't know how to calibrate the effects of any of those things, and I don't think anyone else does either. But those are all potential causes of problems, right? You know, if there really are turnout differentials because Clinton has invested in a field operation that Trump has not invested in, that will matter, of course, to the extent that Obama's field operation was already stronger than Romney's, it may matter less. You know, it's really about the differential versus last time. So this is sort of the set of things that we know we can't measure, but, you know, and add some uncertainty to the estimates, you know, some of which we may be able to sort of get in there and some of which we may not. Those all may be real things that happen in the world, but we don't know how to measure them, so they're not in the model.
Maybe one last question.
Yes. I mean, it seems like you've convinced us you've done as good a job maybe as we can trying to model turnout and deal with some of the uncertainty there.
But
it also seems
enough?
Like one of the conclusions here is if this is screwed up, it's probably screwed up on turnout. And I'm wondering, is there...
No, I think it could still be screwed up on the vote, but
okay,
thank you.
One of the main areas that could be screwed up is on turnout. And I'm wondering, I want to push you a little bit on whether this is really the best we can do. I mean, is there any way we could measure people's anticipated plans of turnout and try to adjust and see, you know...
Right. So in principle...
Hispanic more likely to
okay.
turn out than others.
Here's what you would ideally want. If you were to use self-reported intention to turn out, you would want to have that for a previous election in a high-quality data set, i.e. not an online panel, but like a proper probability survey so that you know that it's actually covering a representative set of people. You would then fit a model which predicted turnout as a function of, you know, past turnout and self-reported intention to turn out and demographics, and you would see, you know, is there any significant coefficient on your intention in predicting whether you actually turned out in that previous election, and then you would apply that model here to the prospective election with the current stated intention to vote as your turnout model. So we did mess around with some of those. We actually just didn't see any significant... There was essentially no association between intention to turn out in the data we have, which are the YouGov panelists, and sort of whether someone voted for Romney or Obama, and so we're like, this isn't going to make any difference, and so we didn't pursue it. We're also a little skeptical that given the online panel and their high rates of interest, that they are representative with respect to We think they're more representative with respect to vote, or we can make them more representative with respect to vote than we can with respect to sort of political engagement type things like turnout.
Right, but I'm asking something much simpler. I mean, I've tried to do this in other contexts as well, and the data is very noisy. But I would think that noise should be somewhat random. I mean, we should be able to tell if we're seeing a very large increase in expected turnout among Hispanics relative to 2012, should this tell us something about this assumption about similar turnout levels?
We did look into it. We decided we couldn't do anything with it, with the data we have, but absolutely it's the case that if you are able to sort of go back, you need to pull together two things. You need to get something about relative intention to turn out before the last election and before the current election. You need that information to make a comparison, and then you need to calibrate how predictive it was in the previous election, net of all the other things you know. Mm-hmm. So there are two ways that you could come to the conclusion that there isn't really any advantage to including it. One is if it wasn't predictive at the last election, conditional on other stuff like previously having voted. And second, if there's no difference in stated intention to turn out from this election to the previous election. So we saw some predictiveness in the previous election when we sort of tried to do some tests. What we didn't see was any clear changes in our data, at least, which is not to say that there aren't more broadly. So we did look into it, but it's hard. And maybe we'll have better data next time because we'll have at least this big giant data set to work with.
Great. I think you've convinced me that you do know what you're talking about and aren't just guessing. So thanks.
Oh, thank you.